At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Hello and welcome to this week's Green Shoots, a history of Irish football. Coming up on this week's show, we have part two of our interview with the great Tony Galvin, where we talk about winning the UEFA Cup with Spurs, playing for the Republic of Ireland, and working with Jack Charlton and Euro 88. Don't forget to share the show on your social media channels to let more people find out about the history and heritage of Irish football. Turn on your notifications on whatever podcast platform you use so that you can get notified straight away when a new episode drops. Now, in our last episode, I started talking to Tony Galvin about growing up with football, his transfer to Tottenham, and that wonderful double FA Cup winning side. And I continued our conversation by asking what it was like playing on that incredible team.
Talk to us about that team as well. I know we'll get onto the UEFA Cup as well in a little bit, but yeah. that team was, I mean, now when you look back at some of the players that you played with and in that team, so many of them are just household names as well now at this stage.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, obviously playing with Ozzy and Ricky, World Cup winners, was a great honour and a pleasure. Learned a lot from Ozzy. Ozzy was a fantastic footballer, a great football brain, wily, clever, wonderful on the ball, very good at closing people down, nicking the ball off people. Glenn was probably a massively underrated player. He was loved by Tottenham supporters. He was an outstanding footballer. Didn't play for England enough. They used to say about Glenn that he couldn't, you know, he didn't work hard enough off the ball. That's why England managers used to say to him. But Ozzy used to say to him, if you were playing in Spain or Argentina, a team would revolve around you. We would find a way to play with you in it.
Mm.
But what was happening at England at the time, they sort of were finding reasons not to have him in the team, which was really strange. So I reckon Glenn left about 30 or 40 England appearances. He was short. Should have played every game. Just build your team around him.
Mm.
Right foot, left foot, crosser, dribbler, wonderful vision. You know, great to watch. Just make sure you've got the right players around him. And that's sort of we tried to at Tottenham.
Mm.
You know, I would sort of do my fair share of running. Glenn would be the massive creator, a wonderful creator from that right-hand side of the field.
Yeah. It's a team that just is filled with so much talent. You've got Chris Hughton,
yeah.
Graham Roberts,
yeah.
Ricky Villa, Steve
yeah.
Perryman,
yeah.
Ozzy.
Steve Perryman, yeah, wonderful captain, yeah.
Yeah, Steve Archibald. As well.
Steve Archibald, world class striker. Garth Crooks, wonderful poacher, yeah. Incredible quick, grease lightning, you know, fantastic turn of pace. But Steve Archibald, we're talking about world class. Went to Barcelona and he's revered still to this day at Barcelona. They absolutely love him. He was total world class. He's come from Aberdeen to Tottenham, won the league there, I think, at Aberdeen against Tottenham, finished up at Barcelona. You know, these are world-class players. Ozzy, clearly, world-class player, won the World Cup. And then you've got Glenn, as you say, Steve Perryman, you know, a handful. Christy was a very underrated fullback. Obviously played many times for the Republic. Republic supporters loved him. And so, yeah, great players. It was a pleasure to play with him.
What's a dressing room like that like to be in and to be around? What was it like? Yeah. Because you got so many players that are so filled with talent.
Yeah, there were no really. Yeah, Stevie would be the person that would keep people on the toes. You know, he'd be keeping people up, sort of having to go at somebody for slightly under par. You know, reminding you to maintain high standards. Ray Clements made a difference. Obviously, he wasn't there in 81, but 82 when Ray Clements came from Liverpool, he instilled the real steel, determination, a fantastic talker behind the back four. Could see the game in front of him, would even tell me that sometimes, which I was couldn't really understand, our goalkeeper would look at me and say, you know, you're not in the right position, or track that man back, or don't let him come inside, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Ray made a big difference. He was a fantastic talker. He really controlled his box, you know, so he made a difference. He was a big influence in the dressing room. Because he, remember where he come from? He come from a dressing room of Dalglish and Rush and Hansen and Lawrence, and he'd come out of a world-class winning dressing room. And he brought that with him to Tottenham. And obviously had a fantastic career there.
Yeah. You mentioned 1982, which is around about when you got a call up to play for Ireland as well. You mentioned that there was trouble getting you into the Republic of Ireland fold in the first place. What was the issue?
Well, the issue was about the birth certificate, as far as I could make out, trying to find out the church where he was born. That was the issue. It just I couldn't really understand it. It seemed pretty straightforward to me.
Yeah.
It just seemed to take a long time. And obviously, you know, you had to be eligible for an Irish passport, so they had to have that evidence. But that's all it was. Owen Hand, who was the manager, was asking, you know, was ready to pick me, but obviously he had to have the say-so from the FAI. You know, there were some interesting characters in the FAI in those days.
I think you'll find
best
there still
not
is.
Not say anymore. Yeah, best not say anymore. So I'll stay out of that one. There were interesting characters there. We had some long times with them. Anyway, it just took too long, and it was frustrating. And then my very first game that I played, we were playing Netherlands in a qualifier, I think a European qualifier. I think we might have been in Rotterdam, I'm not sure. Yeah. Anyway, first game I came back from the game with an injury. I had to come off in the game, and I'd done something to my calf. And Keith then absolutely had a right go of me. He says, I told you not to play the Republic of Ireland. He says, look, you've been there one game and now you come back injured. You're not fit for Saturday. He absolutely went mad, got hold of me. I thought he was going to hit me. I said, well, Keith, I wanted to play, so it just happens. I probably had the injury anyway. But anyway, it came round in the end. It was an unfortunate start getting injured. But it was, again, I was about when I played that first game that it was a step up. There's something, I don't know, they're the same players, but there was a step up in sort of class. You were surrounded by, I mean, Netherlands obviously were always one of the top teams. But straight away, you're up against a team of outstanding individuals. And I felt the game it seemed quite fast. And they all seemed very skillful. And I thought, oh, yeah, this is a step up.
Yeah.
It's different. I don't know what you call it. I don't know. It's just different. It feels different when you're playing international football.
Yeah, international football, though, it's the 1% of the 1% who get to play club football, though, isn't it? It's that tiny sliver of people who actually get called up to play for your country. So it's going to be only the very, very, very best get an opportunity to play.
Yeah, and I was lucky enough to go into a Republic team that had been incredibly close to qualifying on a couple of occasions and had some really outstanding players. And maybe we're just, again, looking for a bit of consistency as a team. But we did have some very, very good players. I mean, I remember one of the greatest players I've ever played with, Liam Brady, was playing. Liam was fantastic to me. He was very helpful. Good to play with. Good talker. Didn't shout a lot, but what a wonderful footballer. Would give you the ball when it was on. Would talk to you. It was a real honour to... I mean, I know some Tottenham supporters don't... Oh, Liam Brady can't talk. I said, well, no, sorry. Class is class.
Yeah.
Arsenal had Liam Brady and Tottenham had Glenn Hoddle. You know, they were the best players in the world. And so it was an honour to play with Liam. Chris, obviously, I knew. Obviously, we had Frank up front. You know, we understand we had Ronnie in those days playing regularly. We had Matt Lawrence and obviously Paul McGrath. Kevin Moran obviously played many times. So we had a very Packy Bonner, So they're again outstanding players, just needed to sort of be a bit more consistent and turn up Absolutely. More regularly and be harder to beat in some games.
Yeah, and that would come, of course, with Jack Charlton. But before we get onto that, because I do want to talk to you about, but the UEFA Cup winning the European trophy is an extraordinary achievement. Talk to us a little bit about that season in 1984 and winning that. Yeah. I noticed, by the way, you started off that tournament giving our own Drogheda United a bit of a smashing.
Yes. Remember it well. Yeah, we have to start somewhere, but as good a place as any to start. So we started there. We got a nice win. Through the tournament, we're probably the best player in his life for Tottenham. It was against Feyenoord, where we won 4-0, 4-2, I think. Mm. I think it was 4-2. And Glenn was outstanding in the first half. I managed to score a couple of goals in that first half. That first half was, people say, was the best anybody had ever seen Glenn play for Tottenham. Mm. Johan Cruyff had wound him up a bit before the game. Johan Cruyff obviously was in his late years, but he wound him up saying he was going to sort Glenn out. And then Glenn delivered a remarkable performance. So then we beat Bayern Munich. I was injured in those games, but we got through Bayern Munich. About the tournament in those days, you know, the Europa Cup is slightly different. It's a different format now. But in those days, the UEFA Cup was obviously the team that hadn't won, everybody, the top four or top three in the countries that hadn't won the league. So you're second, third and fourth. But often the team that won the league the season, often the team that won the league was playing in the UEFA Cup. But they might have finished second the previous season and they won the league the season after. You know, so Bayern Munich may well have won. So it was a competition with all the top teams apart from the team that just previously won the league. They used to say that the European Cup, you played fewer games, and it was arguably easier to win. The UEFA Cup was tough, very tough. And we played Hajduk Split in the semi-final, and my goodness, They did kick shit out over the referee was appalling. You know, they got away with murder. They battered us. We conceded late goals. We lost 2-1. But my God, they should have had about 5 men sent off. It was really intimidating. And remember, in those days, obviously there was no split up of Yugoslavia. Mm. So all the best players stayed in the. They were playing in that. That's now Croatia, but the best players were playing. Hajduk Split was strong. Red Star Belgrade in those days was strong.
Top team.
Partizan Belgrade. But they're really top teams. But then obviously when this country split up and the wall broke, the Berlin Wall, all the best players then start moving around Europe. There was nothing to stop them. Yeah. You know, they would leave East Germany, they'd leave Yugoslavia, they'd leave Bulgaria, they'd go and play in Italy. And, you know, even Russian players would leave. And it was Soviet Union players, sorry. But in those days, it was a very tough competition to win, very tough. And obviously we got through and played Anderlecht in the final. And we played really well over there, should have won that game. And they were arguably the better team in the second leg. And obviously it finished going to penalties. Mm. Memorable evening for supporters because we won the trophy on our own ground. And Spurs hadn't won a European trophy for something like 10 years or so, I think maybe a bit longer. So it was a big thing for that team to win a European trophy. Mm. And quite a few of the top players were injured as well going into the final. There were a few players who missed it. Through injury, and Steve Perryman missed the replay, the second leg, because he was he got a booking in the first game in Anderlecht, and then couldn't play in the return, which was a shame for him because he couldn't sort of lift the cup up. So Graham did it instead, but obviously it was an honour for Graham. But it was a very special evening, the people who were there, because you very rarely get to lift a trophy on that magnitude on your own ground.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
And what's it like playing in those kind of matches? Because they're all kind of, like, Europe is a different style, because obviously you're playing teams that have different kind of mental styles towards the approach of the game, etc. Anderlecht, of course, had surprisingly gotten there after giving Nottingham Forest a bit of a hammering in the second game as well. So do you do a lot of research on the other team, or do you just stick to your own thing?
Well, no, I didn't. No, we didn't. Hopefully the manager might have done, but I don't. We just knew a little bit. We'd seen them on television. They'd won the tournament the previous year.
That's right, yeah.
They were an outstanding team. Yeah. I mean, again, you know, so who'd have thought you'd look at Anderlecht now and you think, well, the thing is that Anderlecht would then get in their players from Denmark and Iceland. They were coming into that team because it was a great team to play for. So they weren't just Belgian players. They had outstanding players, and they had a tremendous record in Europe. And yet they were a very, very good footballing team. So it was a real test to come up against them. You could argue that maybe they were favourites. We hadn't been in the final for a long time. Mm. Again, two games of fantastic atmosphere. Very intimidating over there in Anderlecht, small stadium, but it was absolutely packed. They made a lot of noise. Again, quite intimidating. Lots of dogs lots of those scary Alsatian dogs around them.
Yeah.
Very scary when you went back a corner. I don't know why there were so many Alsatian dogs around the field, but there were a lot. I think they'd been a little bit of trouble the night before, so the police were on red alert.
Mm.
But the home game was nothing like that. It was just a fantastic atmosphere, and it was a really exciting game. We equalised near the end, seconds to penalties. Mm. Went to extra time. There weren't many able to run. I was fortunate because I kept them running with the ball, but we just couldn't get the goal. And so it went to penalties.
Whatever about taking part in a penalty shootout, standing there watching it, hoping for...
Yeah.
What's it like?
Panic. Me and Chris Hume were talking about it a lot. Mickey Hazard had a fantastic season, pulled up sort of... We take the mickey out of him, what other people do, not so much me, but... Oh, Mickey had a fantastic game, he had a fantastic tournament, but he just seemed to get a bit of cramp when we were going into penalties, just before we were going to penalties. So Mickey didn't take a penalty, would have been a certainty. And then the mystery was, well, I mean, we missed, then obviously Parksy got us back in it. Then before Parksy made that final save, Tony Parks, who'd had a fantastic tournament as well. There'd be me and Chris. I'm not too sure about Mickey, whether Mickey was involved. Sort of looking at each other, talking to each other, who's next? Because then it's sudden death. I mean, basically, you're shitting yourself, aren't you? I mean, let's be honest. If anybody says otherwise, it's a load of rubbish. We'd taken some penalties, and we'd just been told, same old story, make a decision, don't change your mind. If you're going to hit it in a certain position, just do it and try and put your foot through it.
Did the manager?
I was hoping it didn't come to that.
Yeah. Did the manager ask for volunteers, or did he point at people and go, "You"?
No,
you.
I don't recall anything being happened. But then Chris said he'd mentioned to me that he, which I don't remember the time, but he'd been told to be ready for a penalty, that Chris might be the next one. And I suppose then it would, you know, maybe me after Chris. I think they trusted Chris a bit more than me. I'm not too sure, but we knew it could come to that. But it was incredible. For some reason, there weren't a lot of penalties around in those days, were there? There were. You didn't see so many penalties. There weren't that many penalties shootouts that I can recall watching on television. They seem to be so common these days. They're everywhere, aren't they? But in those days, they didn't seem that common. And obviously, because in Europe, the away goals rule, right, that means you have fewer ones because the away goals came to effect, which to avoid penalties. That avoided penalties. But yeah, they were quite a rarity. Great for football supporters to watch, but only great if you come through them. Not so great if you don't. I mean, look what happened the other night. You know, it could have gone either way against Paris Saint-Germain. But it's great if you win. Not so great if you don't.
Absolutely, yeah. What's it like, by the way? You'd lifted trophies at Wembley. What's it like lifting one at White Hart Lane?
Yeah, that's incredibly special, different feeling. You know, so that's a moment that really stays with you. And the thing that I always remember is walking around the ground after the game, parading the cup, because you've got your all 95% of the supporters in the ground are your supporters. So therefore they are, well, maybe 90%, but you can see the joy in the face. There's lots of children near the front. So it was, I think we had the railings up then, didn't we, round grounds?
That's right, yeah.
And the faces pressed up against railings or fences, whatever you call them. But a lot, massive joy. A lot of the kids have been pushed to the front so they could see the players. But yeah, that was really special. And again, people remember being there that night, seeing us parading around the cup. You know, it's just, we talk about this a lot. If all the people who say they're at the game watching that game, there's been about a million people inside that ground. So many people were there. And I thought, well, that's just physically not possible that all these people are in that ground. You know, I think there was an awful lot of people on the high road outside. Yeah, it's special for the supporters, and obviously it's something you don't really forget readily, because then obviously later years it moved to being to not being a two-leg game, didn't it? To be a one-off game, which isn't necessarily quite the same.
Yeah. I know we're running out of time, but I just wanted to ask you about, I suppose,
yeah, no problem.
Your own career then after that, when David Pleat arrived after Keith was, I suppose, ousted as manager. So explain to us, I suppose, the change that happened, because it seems as if when Keith Birkinshaw left, that's when, I suppose, a little bit of magic left as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as I say, Peter's first season as manager was very successful, did really well, but we just couldn't quite do it in the league. But the season after, we were very good, with a few injuries here and there, players off form. Peter Shreve loses his job, then David Pleat comes in, wants to change the team. Initially, I'm starting off in the team. He's slightly trying a different format. He starts to play one up front with a five-man midfield. You know, I mean, I'm in the team for most of the early part of the season. Then Steve Hodge came in and sort of played in my position, but a different role. But I did play in a few games and quite enjoyed it. He liked a more of a flexible type of midfield. Obviously, I was used to sort of being a fairly fixed on the left-hand side, but he liked players to change positions, move around. And it was great to watch that first season, great to be part of. It was a different, you could see he wanted to change the, and then players gradually left. Graham left, Glenn left, Paul Miller left, then I left. We hung around for a bit longer. Ozzy hung around for a bit longer, but obviously he was trying to build a team. But unfortunately, they got to the FA Cup final, lost in extra time, were favourites to win it. And then early on in the next season, he basically told me that I had no choice, that if I stayed at the club, I wouldn't be playing in the reserves. That's what managers used to do in those days. There was pre-Bosman, so you had no power. I was on a contract, so I had no say in the matter, really. So it was a question, what do I do? So I signed for Sheffield Wednesday because I just wanted to go carry on playing. But probably looking back, probably should have dug my heels and maybe stung around a bit longer. So 6 weeks later or a month later, David Pleat gets sacked because of things that we don't need to go into, but you can look them up on the internet, reasons why he lost his job. Non-footballing reasons, let's put it like that.
Okay.
And Yeah, you can look that one up. I'm not saying a word. So anyway, but I carried on playing for, then I was, and I wasn't so regular then, but I carried on playing for the Republic of Ireland, and it was while I was at Sheffield Wednesday that we got to the Euros in 1988. So yeah. I was a Wednesday then.
Yeah, and
I'm not playing that regularly because you know, Howard Wilkinson, who was the manager, tried to change the way Sheffield Wednesday were playing a more of a sort of enterprising attacking style, different players, but they struggled a bit, and then he went back to a certain style of football that didn't really suit some of us, so a few of us had to go back in the reserves. Yeah, he tried to change it, and then he left and went to Leeds. But I obviously carried on playing for the Republic of Ireland.
Yeah, and it's interesting as well, because the in that period, you were kind of playing regularly for the Republic of Ireland as well, and and obviously Jack really, Jack Charlton really kind of felt that you were doing the job for him. I mean, I suppose an atypical kind of, what was a Jack Charlton team like to play under?
Well, Jack was obviously Owen, I would say, would be more of an attacking, you know, want to be a entertaining, so slightly sort of less organized team. Jack came in, was very organized, and sort of simple messages to convey. He didn't want, for example, anybody to sort of overpass at the back. He wanted the ball to move forward quite quickly, and he wanted players to push up through the field. He didn't want centre-halves passing the ball across the box in front of the goalkeepers. If you did that, oh my God, you'd get it at half-time. So the ball would go forward fairly quickly, and he wanted the midfield players to support the front, really. And obviously I was quite able to do that. I wasn't that bothered, you know, I was just happy to be on the team. But it was a hard work. We had to work hard. You know, I remember John Aldridge going a long spell without scoring a goal. But it's because he was working his bollocks up front, you know. The idea was we tried to keep the ball in, pen them in, you know, as in some modern day, you know, we didn't want them to sort of play fancy football through us. And, you know, and so Jack wanted us to push forward, get the balls in the box, be a little bit more direct, but all know our defensive duties when they got the ball. So, you know, you all had a position to fill. Mm. But he didn't like you overplaying in your own sort of, if you like, your final third. He wanted the ball to get further forward up the field. I remember him saying to Liam Brady, you can do what you like in that final third. Don't care what you can dribble past, do anything you want. But I don't want you doing it in front of our box. I don't want you doing it there. I don't want you receiving the ball in our final third. You see, Liam was used to picking the ball up. So there was an element of, there's always a bit of a problem there with some of the players, the Liverpool players, the Man United players. But in the end, there was two ways to do it. There was their way and there was Jack's way, and their way was never going to win. And that, so they had to adapt. The lads had to adapt for playing for Man United in a certain way, or Liverpool. But coming to play for the Republic, you played a different style of football. Mm. And that was, and if you wouldn't do it, Jack didn't care. He would drop you. He wouldn't play you. No, he had numerous issues with David O'Leary as well. You know, he had issues with certain players, and if he just wanted them to play the way he told them to play, if he didn't, he wouldn't play.
One of the things I read about Jack was that he didn't want players overthinking. He wanted a simple game where everybody knew from the beginning this is what your job was, and the end.
Yes.
Don't try and kind of over elaborate on things. You know.
But it was slightly misunderstood. He would criticize players for overplaying the wrong parts of the field. It was slightly misunderstood, but he wanted players to express themselves in the final part of the field. He wanted the expression, he wanted you to take people on. He wanted you to play 1-2s. He would let you do that, but he didn't want you doing it in your own half, if you like. But he wanted you to cross the ball, get the ball in the box, score goals. But we had to work hard when we didn't have the ball. We did have to work hard because obviously you're playing against some great players.
Yeah.
And I remember going to 1990, I was injured, so I wasn't in the squad. But I would have been if I'd have been fit. See, even Jack wanted me to go. Jack didn't really like big squads anyway, but he said, look, I just want people around the squad who I can trust, you know, turn up for training, help when required. You know, you're not going to be playing in the team because I'm probably going to be using 14 or 15 players and you're not one of them. But unfortunately, I couldn't do that. But he just liked people around him who he could trust. And that meant players as well, you know, in training sessions and things like that. And in 1990, it was a continuation of the way the team played. They were a bloody hard team to play against in 1990, yeah. England. Against England, when they equalised, you know, they showed a lot of spirit to come back in that game. It was Kevin Sheehan scored, didn't he? So they were a hard team to play against in 1990. Italy only beat 1-0 in the quarterfinals, remember?
That's right, yeah. And we talked about that on the podcast as well. But your own experience, though, at Republic of Ireland, we qualify for Euro 88 thanks to our thanks to our Scottish neighbours.
Yeah, we know that. We know all that. Yeah, yeah.
What about your own kind of thoughts on the, I suppose, Euro 88 as well? Because you played in all the games and you had a big part in that too. So
I like obviously the Republic of Ireland. Again, you know, played the Republic of Ireland quite late. Everything happened late because of the nature of how I'd come into football. But obviously a highlight was Euro 88. Beating England was incredible. But we played so well in the first half in that game, worked really hard. It was a boiling hot day. Second half, we were hanging on. Glenn Hoddle came off. Typical. Glenn wasn't in the team. Came in the second half and sort of tore us apart. Just, you know, for some reason, Bobby Robson decided he wasn't going to play again in the starting in the team. But we were hanging on for dear life in the second half. And it was purely simply because we worked so hard in the first half. And then Packy had probably one of the best games of his life. The lads defended well. We got over the line. Obviously, that is a memorable occasion for any Republic supporter.
Was there
England?
Do you mind me asking? Was there any conflict in terms of yourself, or did you get stick from fans? Because I mean, you're born in England. You played England schools as well. So
to all them, because I'd never played against England. Some of the other lads had. I'd never played against England. Obviously, this was England, not at Wembley. It was England in a neutral country, so to speak. But even though, obviously, we had fantastic support, England also had fantastic support when they go abroad. And I didn't realise that there was so much negativity towards me, I suppose, because it might be because when you play in a wide position, you hear a lot. And one thing I always tried not to do was not respond, not make eye contact when you go to pick a throw. Don't look anybody in the eye. That's dangerous. Just look at the ball and ignore them. But there was a lot of nasty sort of aggression, because obviously they knew I was English and I was playing for the Republic Crown. There were a lot of supporters. And these are people who are supporting, you know, Grimsby or lower league clubs. They're from all around the country, and it was quite nasty. And then Chrissy Waddle was playing as well. Obviously, I knew Chrissy well. He was laughing at me before the game, thinking, you know, here we are. And they were so confident when that game started. They looked very confident. They looked like, oh, this won't be a problem. And I think they suffered a little bit from that in that, particularly in that first half. But yeah, the crowd there was plenty of stick flying around from the English supporters. Yeah, it wasn't very pleasant. But you know, I was playing for the Republic Ireland. I had the green shirt on, and the rest is history.
Yeah.
Very enjoyable after the game. It was as well, incredibly enjoyable. I don't think I've seen so many Irish supporters so happy. Well, I'm sure they were happy in years later, but you know, beating England in Stuttgart, that was a very memorable occasion. Very memorable.
We talked about it on the podcast before that Euro 88, 1990 captured the imagination of the whole country, but Euro 88 was for the real kind of diehard football fans who've been through the so closes
the years. Exactly. Yeah, I completely agree with that. Obviously, I wasn't involved in those near misses that they'd done in previous years, but Euro 88 was a very, very special. It was like a milestone in the country's football in history. It was a milestone. Not only did they beat England in that game, but then the game after when we played Russia or whatever it was called, SSR, you know, whatever SSR, name they were going under at the time. Yeah, and they were absolutely, that's the best Irish performance I've ever played in. Arguably maybe that or Scotland away when we played really well in the qualifying where Matt Lawrence has gone. But we played some wonderful football. Unusually for us, we were sort of really playing some entertaining stuff against them. How we drew that game, I'll never know. Mm. It was just ridiculous. We completely, you know, loss of typical at that level, slight loss of concentration towards the end of the game. They get an equaliser, don't deserve it. I got brought down, which I didn't even realise at the time. But Jack was going mad after the game because he floated the officials. I was upended by the goalkeeper. Well, I didn't realise at the time, but then I've seen it since, and it was like an abominable challenge. He's actually taken me out completely. Referees, because it was the Republic, all the decisions seemed to just go against you. You know, they went in favour of him because he was a top international goalkeeper. He just completely hammered me. And I'm nowhere near the ball. It was a blatant penalty. And obviously, we'd have scored that. We'd have gone 2-0 up. It was unbelievable. And then John missed an header that we should have scored. And then, you know, we so should have won that game. Mm. But that was very memorable for a different reason, because we played some wonderful football. We could be hard to play against, but play entertaining, forward attacking football as well and be good to watch.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's often an accusation that's pointed against Jack Charlton teams, that, you know, we kind of sat behind the ball, we 11 men behind the ball and stuff like that. But if you go back and you watch, you know, some of the goals that we scored under Jack, some of them are quite free flowing and they're brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking at the goal that Ray scored in USA, didn't he? Mm-hmm. It was against Italy, wasn't he? I mean, it's called fantastic goals. Corky did. They were a good team. He was a very good manager. He had a way of playing at international level that's quite slightly unusual. And he got the best out of his players, and he was a very well organised man. People thought he was a bit, you know, off the cuff, but he wasn't. He was organised and knew what he wanted. Mm. And once the players get into a system, they start to believe and accept it. Then they start to express themselves when they have the opportunity as well. And that's what happened. The players got used to it. Mm. And they said, well, this is the way we're going to play, you know. But, you know, when we're in certain positions, yeah, we'll take that player. And yes, I will do something different. Jack's not going to have a go at me for doing that. Mm. He'll have a go at me if I'm doing it in front of my if I'm 10 yards away from my goalkeeper. Yeah. But that. He was, he was misjudged, I think. Mm. Hopefully not in the Republic, but
no.
In other countries, I think he was misjudged. Mm. I think he was. He was fast. There was a lot more going on up there than people thought or realised.
Mm. I just briefly on the Russia game, I realised that you have a degree in Russian studies, and that might have helped too.
Yeah, I did. I had a degree in Russian studies, so it is true that I did go up to somebody in Rubatka, which was shared, and I did ask for somebody's shirt, and I got short shrift. They weren't allowed to swap shirts on the, I think it was on the field, and I think they were very happy because I think we just basically outplayed them, and they nicked a result.
Mm.
So I got short shrift there, and I'm trying to swap shirts on the field. You picked up the occasional word, but basically you're not paying a lot of attention. Because you're just focused on your own game. So I wouldn't say it helped me in any way, but it was a memorable occasion to play against them and just not so memorable the fact we didn't beat them.
Mm. We knocked out then by, was it the Netherlands that knocked
Netherlands,
you out?
Netherlands, yeah. In that famous weird goal that sort of span and... in another occasion, it could have been an offside involved. It was a very strange goal, very unusual. I mean, don't get me wrong, they played us to death, particularly in the second half. Again, it was they were probably the best footballing team I've ever played against anywhere, any time. They were an unbelievable team. I mean, just look who was playing in that team. Rudolph Van Basten, Rijkaard, Coleman, Coleman at the back. You know, they had such a wonderful team, and they were, you know, they should have won the World Cup. Mm. But they, well,
They won the Euros, though. I mean, that was the...
Yeah, they won the Euros. Yeah, what, so I'm saying they won the Euros. Van Basten scored an amazing goal. They were red hot favourites to win the World Cup, but the Dutch do this. They all seem to sort of fall out with each other.
Yeah.
But it was an honour to play in that game, and we did really well. We started off a bit like the England game, but it was a boiling hot day, and I think again we just ran out of legs. But we thought we were clinging on. We thought we might just hold on. But fair dues to them, you know. If you're going to get beat, you're going to get beat by probably time was the best team in the world. And we gave it a really good go. I mean, Paul McGrath had a very good game. Paul was a highly underrated player. Jack loved Paul as well.
Mm.
Paul just went out and did a job. Never didn't say a lot. Just did a very good job wherever you played him. Could play centre half. Could play centre midfield. Outstanding player. And I thought he was outstanding that day. But Jack loved Paul. We all did because we thought he was a fantastic player. Yeah, I'm talking about Paul in the past, but I shouldn't have done. I mean, we all love Paul as a player. He was a fantastic player. He was a good bloke, great bloke as well. Yeah. Scary on the field. It sounded like one of those people who don't say a lot, but just go about the business really well.
Yeah, it's. I think particularly, obviously, we remember him from Republic of Ireland side of things, and obviously there is Aston Villa and so on, but I think one of his great qualities was he didn't have to shout at people. He didn't have to scream. He did it in his play. He led by example. Yeah.
Led by example. Yeah. You know, he'd be in the Roy Keane mold of players. I'm not saying he was like Roy Keane as a person because I never played with Roy, but, he was inspirational to have on your team. Just to go about his business. Fierce in the tackle, uncompromising, but, you know, could get forward. Great, great engine. Just great all-round ability. An absolute bonus to for any team to have him.
Mm.
And as I said, Jack loved him, liked him playing in that position in his team. You know, he thought he did a great job. And Paul responded.
Mm. What about your own career then? It kind of, I suppose, injury kind of comes around and takes its toll. And
no. I mean, you come to the end, did a bit of coaching. I was an assistant manager with Aussie at Newcastle for a while. That didn't go very well. So coaching career was a bit sort of short. You know, in those days, you had to get a job. So I went back into teaching because you didn't earn enough money in those days not to have a job after football. Which was fine. You know, many players these days seem to complain about what it's like when they retire from football. Well, you know, I suggest to go out and get a job or do something useful. But maybe I'd sound a bit unsympathetic. But, you know, you've got to sometimes just get on, move on from what you've done. And I carried on doing a bit of coaching at sort of lower league level. Always associated with coaching kids, still do a bit of coaching. But I do wonder what, you know, did the players who retired in those days who didn't have a lot of money, you know, no one seemed to show a lot of care about how they were looked after. They weren't particularly well looked after in those days, certainly before my time, in the 60s and 70s. You know, some of them struggled after football. A lot more so than they do now because of the money they earn. You're playing in the top two divisions in England. You know, you're fairly well set for life.
Mm. We've kind of talked about it on the podcast before as well. A lot of players seem to kind of, I suppose they play their career, but they're also saving money to open up a pub or, you know, something like that. Yeah. Something so because they knew once the football finished, you needed a job.
Yeah, absolutely. That was a lot of the lads who I would have played against and before me would do something like that. Or you know, there were limited jobs in coaching because obviously if in those days, your football clubs used to have a manager and an assistant manager, and maybe a coach, and maybe a reserve. You know, maybe there are three or four jobs. I mean, now in the football clubs seem to carry enormous staff, don't they? Seven or eight coaches, defensive coaches, someone into non-league, some open pubs, some open restaurants, some went into teaching, some did different things. Some struggled, you know, some struggled. But a lot of good lads around, some I see occasionally, obviously some of the ex-Spurs players I see. I sounded unsympathetic, which I probably shouldn't be, because obviously I don't want people to be depressed when they finish playing football and wondering what they're going to do. But maybe they need to prepare a little bit better for life after football.
I suppose, if you look back on your own career and your football and life, how would you assess your football and career then from?
Okay, that's interesting. I suppose I would regard myself as being lucky to get involved, and because, you know, could quite easily have just stayed in non-league, played at lower level. So I got that break that Bill gave me, so thanks to Bill. I got the break getting to the Spurs first team. I got the opportunity to play for the Republic of Ireland. So thanks to my granddad for that, who's long gone. And I also got the chance, you know, that, so I thank Owen for giving me that opportunity. But obviously later on, thank Jack for showing a lot of faith in me. Obviously, I was compressing a lot of things into a short space of time. Because I arrived in football late. So there was a lot of catching up to do. And, you know, it was quite hard. So I had to cram as much as I could into my career. So lucky, definitely lucky. And appreciative of what football gave to me. I think it gave me an awful lot. So thanks to the football. And also thanks to all the supporters who I see now, who have happy memories. So thanks to them. So a lot of thanks go out. Very appreciative. I think I was a bit lucky, but found it all very enjoyable. And took a lot of stick from various supporters over the years, some of them my own supporters. Certainly maybe at Sheffield Wednesday that would apply, but you've got to be tough. You've got to accept it. You're a professional footballer. Live to fight another day. Yeah, you've got to be a strong character in to succeed in football. You have to be a strong character, strong-willed, put up with a bit of stick and get on with it next time round. You have a bad day, get up and go again. Yeah.
Yeah. It's.
But I think I was lucky.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And a lot of hard work as well to go into that too, you know.
Yeah, well, I can see that's coming from sort of where I came from. Maybe the rugby union and playing non-league football. Hard work was a given. Hard work to me is a given as a professional sportsman. It's a given. You shouldn't be, oh, I gave 100%. No, it's a given. If you don't do that, you don't deserve to be in that position in the first place. Hard work, whatever you do, it must be the bare minimum, really. And on top of that, you've got to add your ability and your mental strength as well. Mental strength, very important.
Absolutely fantastic. Tony, thank you very much for coming on the podcast. It's been an absolute joy.
No problem. Yeah, thanks for some very interesting questions. It's been enjoyable. All the best. Have a great day.
Super. You too, Tony.
The great Tony Galvin there. His book, by the way, is Galvanized, the footballing tale of brothers Chris and Tony Galvin as well. A great read for anybody interested in great footballing stories. Don't forget to share the show on your own social media channels to let more people find out about the history and heritage of Irish football. Turn on your notifications on whatever podcast platform you use so that you can get notified straight away when a new episode drops. And remember, to support your local League of Ireland and Northern Ireland Football League club, it's our heritage, it's our game. Bye for now.
KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.